welcome to Full Release with Samantha Bee. Hopefully, you'll experience one by the end of this. And if you're joining us for the first time, be prepared for about 25% less shrillness from yours truly. Why? Because, well, on my late night show, I take down fat cats. But on this show, I get to snuggle up from a distance with the human equivalent of adorable kittens. We're back after a short summer break that has me both feeling rejuvenated and terrified as ever about the state of the world. In other words, if you're hearing this and there's been another coup attempt, hopefully this podcast will help you soothe your frayed nerves. I'm joined as always by my producers, Adam Howard and Svea Baron Reinstein. Okay, podcast gals, we got our first Biden administration official on today's show, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. Now, all of us are veteran users of one of the most infamous transportation systems in the world. What is your craziest New York City transportation experience?
I feel like everyone has a lot. Mine was right around when I moved here. Mm-hmm. Every year there's something called the No Pants Subway Ride, but I had never heard of it before.
Oh, no.
And I was riding on the subway like a normal, new to New York lady.
Yeah.
And all these people got on with no pants on. But like whenever something weird happens on the subway, the New Yorker thing to do is just to completely ignore it.
Right.
So yes. I tried my best, but it was hard because I also didn't know that it was an event. But then people kept getting on at every station with no pants on.
Oh, and you're like, is this a prank just on me because I'm new?
Right. Did everybody... Is this just a Sunday thing?
Pantsless.
Do you get a reduced fare if you're wearing no pants?
Pantsless subway. Adam, have you had... I'm sure you've had most crazy subway experiences involve someone pooping.
Well, it's funny because I first was going to say I once had a woman faint on me. Like I felt like something like hit me in the back of the head. And again, being like a normal New Yorker, I was like, I'm going to ignore this shit. Whatever it is can't be good. And I look behind me and a woman had like just been lightheaded and fallen backwards on me. But the craziest ever was I once witnessed a woman being choked. It was like an early morning commute. It was a super packed train. It was like dead of winter. Everyone was just sort of miserable. And this older woman, she kind of like, she did a slightly obnoxious thing, which she sort of slid into a seat that this other woman was about to take. And this woman just like did not skip a beat. She immediately grabbed this woman and like kind of choke her like very quickly. It was so fast that it was like, is that... That's happening. Oh, it's happening. And then before anybody could intervene, she just like ran off the train and then went up the steps and like went to the other side of the platform. And so somebody had like pulled the emergency lever thing because the train had stopped moving.
Oh,
and
you never
everybody,
want that to happen.
Right. That's always people do it at the wrong moment. And so then we saw this choker like walking back and forth, kind of like pacing in a huff on the other side of the platform. And this very lackadaisical MTA worker kind of was like, well, do you want to report the incident? And we're like, the woman's right there. Like, go get her. And like eventually this woman left. The woman who got choked was sort of like a hard-bit New Yorker. And she was just kind of like, I just want to get to work. And so like we were like, all right. And then the train, we just moved on. I should have prefaced all this that New York is an amazing city and most people are incredibly nice, but this was like a bad one.
Awful. Yeah. Oh my God. Well, maybe it's just mine that are all poop related. No, that's not true. The first poop related story is actually Jason's, my husband. He saw a man. He was like, we were so green. We were so new. We were still like at the point where you see it like a stray cat and call the NYPD. We're like, there's a problem. There's a cat walking around. No one seems to own it. And like we dialed 911. And he was riding the subway and he was on the platform once and he saw a man in a full business suit, like fully dressed up man, get off the subway with his briefcase, take his pants down, poop on the platform, pull his dress his business suit up and like walk to work or whatever. Anyway, awful.
Oh no.
But I was riding the subway once and like it was so crowded. The doors, it was like sardine, you know, everybody's just compressed and pressed up against the glass windows. And the doors opened and a pregnant woman, like a really pregnant woman, went reeling out of the car and smashed her face on the wall.
Whoa.
And broke the wall.
What? She smashed
her face so hard into the tile that the wall cracked. Like her face cracked the tiles, and then she fell backwards, and her nose was completely broke, and she was totally fine. But it was like, ah! It was just one of those. She was fine. Everybody was fine. Well, I can't say that I followed up, but she was actually fine. And she was like, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm completely fine. But she broke the wall with her face. You know what I mean?
Yeah, anyways, I think so.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, New York is alive.
New York is vibrant.
Please come visit.
We're coming back to life. Our tiles
People
are,
are
weak.
Pooping on the train again. Nature is healing.
Okay, I'm so excited to talk to Pete Buttigieg. We're going to take a quick break, but we have Pete Buttigieg coming up. You are not going to want to miss this. I just want to say, due to some technical difficulties, there might be some rough audio patches, so thanks for bearing with us. Listen, Pete Buttigieg is the Secretary of Transportation. He's not the Secretary of Audiovisuals, okay? Joining me today is Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg at just 39 years old. I'm so much older than him. Secretary Buttigieg has one of the most impressive resumes ever. He's not only the first openly LGBTQ member to be confirmed to a presidential cabinet, but he's also the youngest person ever to fill his role. Prior to serving in the Biden administration, Secretary Buttigieg was a major contender for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination, a popular two-term mayor of South Bend, Indiana, a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, and a Rhodes Scholar. Here's hoping he never tries to break into late-night comedy, because I'm sure he'd run away with that, too. Welcome to the show, Secretary Buttigieg.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Big fan. Excited to be doing this.
Is it Infrastructure Week? Is every week Infrastructure Week, or is this actually Infrastructure Week?
I'm thinking of this as the summer of infrastructure. Each Infrastructure Week building on the last. Look, I mean, Infrastructure Week became a joke because, you know, nothing actually happened. But you can feel things happening right now. We just got to keep it going.
Yeah. It's like Infrastructure Year. It should be Infrastructure Decade, really.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of work to be done.
Oh, I mean, kidding apart, I think the 2020s could go down in history.
Right.
Just look at all of the changes coming to the transportation sector in this decade, and it could be probably since the 50s and maybe more than that, I think the most transformative. Which is exciting.
This is very exciting. Okay, well, speaking of transformation, how's your COVID going? Like, how's your COVID year going? You know, you have to ask. It's very, we seem to be, I guess I don't say that question lightly, even though it came out in that way. What I mean is, I just can't believe that we're still in this predicament, and I cannot believe that what we're facing seems so huge and looming again. We just have, it feels like we've just blown the greatest opportunity to put this disease to rest. And I don't know how you feel about that. I'm sure you feel, I'm answering the question for you. You feel badly about it.
Obviously, it's frustrating to have setbacks and to face new challenges with things like this Delta variant. On the other hand, this is not 2020. When we went through the toughest moments of this pandemic, there was also a sense of powerlessness that we were waiting on a vaccine. Everybody was vulnerable. There were things you could do, isolating, masking, all of which came, especially the isolating, at a terrible cost. And then nothing you could do, in a certain sense, medically, until the vaccine came. Now we're in a whole different place. There's something everybody can do, which is to get the vaccine. And if you have done so, to find ways to guide other people that you care about to do the same. Because that's still the solution. The shape of the problem has changed a little bit with things like the Delta variant, right? But one thing we know, even with some of the finding about the possibility of vaccinated people still being at risk of having a high load of transmission, is A, it's going to save your life, and B, the fewer people are unvaccinated, the less of a pool there is for this virus to swim around in and mutate it effectively. Right. So the difference this year, I think, is we know what we have tools that we can understand. It's still a huge challenge. It's a human challenge.
Yes. Well, you're such a persuasive speaker. So how do you, what do you advise? How do you communicate with or persuade people who have, convinced themselves that by not getting vaccinated, they're
owning the libs or something that just like makes no sense. How do you dig into that? Like you personally, because you're very good at that. What is your technique?
I mean, I think about it a few different ways, depending on why somebody's hesitant, right? There's hesitancy in a lot of communities that have had very bad experiences with the U.S. medical establishment. So that's understandable. There is hesitancy in very different areas that are basically taking marching orders from an ideological extreme. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, in all cases where people have questions, the most effective thing you can do is point people to trusted sources. And the trusted source might not be me, right? It might be your doctor. It might be talk to your doctor. You know, I think one of the reasons it's important that community leaders speak with that is that they can reach people in a way that government officials or celebrities can't.
Right.
The other thing I think that's important for talking to communities today is to remind people of their own agency. So I have heard, even in my own extended family, people mm-hmm. saying things like, I think God will take care of me.
Right.
And it's important to say that this vaccine could be viewed as the answer to a lot of prayers. And since when do you let God do all the work when you have an opportunity to protect yourself and protect other people? So different people really are for different reasons. But let me also say the president did the right thing by moving forward to say, look, if you work for the federal government, if you're in a position of trust, then we need you to either get vaccinated or be ready for a lot of testing and masking so that we can make sure that it's a safe workplace. And I think those steps are important too.
Right. What does your workplace look like? Is everybody coming in all the time? Do you have waves of people coming in? I assume everybody's masked inside. Like, what does your workplace look like? Do you have a mix of?
Right now we're on a maximum telework posture. And it can be eerie. I'm frequently in the office, but it often feels like when you go to the office on a Sunday and you're the only one there, we have a very small team that's there with us. Occasionally I'm walking around other parts of the building and you go by, you know, cubicles where there are workplaces where there's a sweater draped over a chair or a bag of chips on the desk. And you think about the fact that's been there for a year and a half. Now that employee has been working for that year and a half, doing great work.
Right.
But we have been in that max telework. And now I'm eager to get back to where we can more often be in a room with our colleagues.
Right.
On the other hand, I think as we're working through this as an employer, we've got 55,000 people working in part of the transportation. And some of them, you know, a lot of them are air traffic controllers. So telework's never been an option for them.
Right.
But for those who work in an office, I think it's important to think, okay, we have an opportunity.
Right.
What in a perfect world would the future work look like? And then how can we get from here to there?
I like how you phrase it, maximum telework posture. That's the approach that I am also taking. And I'm going to give it that official name moving forward because it just sounds much better than me going, I just feel like we should stay home for a little bit longer. I don't mind Zoom meetings. I mean, I don't love them, but it's fine. Okay. I want to talk to you about infrastructure and I want to talk to you about green initiatives and electric cars and all of that stuff. So like, first talk to me about how having been a mayor, how does that affect your approach to infrastructure?
Well, when you're a mayor, you live and breathe infrastructure.
Right.
I mean, you're literally getting phone calls when there's potholes. You're, in our case, you know, running a water utility and a wastewater utility. A huge part of your job is infrastructure. And really, you begin to realize that your job, and I would argue the job of infrastructure, is to be so smooth and effective that people don't think about it. So the way I always talk about it is that you know, something as basic and unglamorous as drinking water or a road being paved is actually connected to something as profound as the meaning of life in this sense. You can better lead a meaningful life if you don't have to spend any time thinking about infrastructure, right? You don't have to wonder for a second whether the glass of water comes out of your tap in the kitchen is safe or not. Then you have more of that attention to give to whatever is meaningful in your life, whether it's work or family or faith or scholarship, or whatever you care about, you can apply yourself to it. As long as you don't have to worry about how am I actually going to get there? Is there a safe way to get to my school or class? Is there an internet connection? Right? These things that are designed to be in the background so we do whatever we care about.
Right. Should we? I mean, I feel like this country cannot tolerate any more neglect. I honestly feel like sometimes you just go to parts of the country that where you can see that a bridge is crumbling, and you can see that the roads are crumbling, and you feel that just decay. Like, how scared should we be, or are you just is going to get all fixed?
Yeah, we're in trouble. I mean, we're planning to fix it all, but right. look, this is decades of disinvestment
right.
catching up to us. We've been doing this for decades, and it turns out you can actually coast for a while on what previous generations have done. I mean, again, when I was mayor in South Bend, we were relying on trails, pieces of infrastructure along the river that were put in during the New Deal. Mm-hmm. But so is Pittsburgh with their locks and dams. We went out and saw that for ourselves. Right. And you can get away with that for a few years or maybe even a few decades. But now, I was in the Hudson River tunnels.
Okay.
Hundreds of thousands of passengers pass through these tunnels in and out of the New York area on trains. It is the best construction technology of 1910. And we're leaning on it in 2021. And if we don't fix it, that will catch up to us. America has fallen out of the top 10 in infrastructure as far as transportation. Some rankings of the world's top airports, not one of the top 25 is a U.S. airport.
Right.
And, sure, we can continue to exist as a country, but we can't continue to be a leading country unless we step it up. That's what the president's vision is all about. That's what this bill is all about, that we're working on a bipartisan basis.
So right now, at the time of this recording, things look good with the bill. Things could always change. But as we sit here now, 17 Senate Republicans, including Mitch McConnell, are supporting the bipartisan infrastructure deal. How concerned are you about holding that coalition of relatively sane Republicans? How concerned are you about holding that coalition together? Like, does it feel, it just feels so fragile to me.
Yeah, progress is very fragile in today's Washington. We're talking about a federally divided place. We're talking about people who don't usually agree on much. But I think what's holding it together and what's stable and strong is the range of Americans who get the need to do this. So, for example, we've had labor leaders and business leaders in the Chamber of Commerce and related organizations all saying together, you got to pass this thing. And that very rarely happens on an issue of economic policy. Just as you very rarely these days see Republicans and Democrats walk out of the West Bank with the president and get a deal on a big issue. So I think that's real. I think that it's not to be taken for granted. We have to keep maintaining this coalition that wants to get this done. But what I'm finding is so powerful, especially as I travel, is every one of these members of Congress, the House, Senate, Democrat, Republican, they're all from somewhere. They're all going home to a district where their constituents are saying, this bridge is not going to last much longer.
Right. I feel like having worked in political comedy for as long as I have, which is not a real job mostly, but kind of is, when I got started in this field, there were so many more just kind of like individual projects that political leaders would get done, just like sending some pork their way and like backroom deals and handshake commitments to a bridge or a road or something like that in their own communities. And that way of doing business is largely kind of, it has changed a lot. And I think a lot has gotten a chance to decay in that time. Does that feel accurate to you? Or is that just me thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are lots of stories, right? Of some powerful member of Congress gets this project, which might have been needed or might not have, and gets it done. I think now we're in an era where there's a lot more scrutiny. There's a lot more transparency. So even if a project is guided by a member of Congress, by the way, that's part of their job, right? Is to make sure that things that need to happen, happen. But it happens in the context of legislation that everybody can see what's going on, that's voted on by everybody. And, we take very seriously our responsibility as a department to make sure that when Congress gives us these dollars to work with, that we push them out in a way that makes sense and that everybody can feel good about. Because obviously the history of, if you go back to America's past, right, there's a history of spectacular corruption in the way that railroads were built, in the way that highways were built. One good thing about the time we live in is that there's a different expectation.
Right. Yeah, I don't advocate that we go back to full corruption.
You just for medium corruption?
No, medium. No, I just sort of remember that the way that we talk about these things has actually evolved over time, even since I've been in this field. And do you think that just like the visuals or just constituents being so aware of things that need to be done in their own communities, it's just like so undeniable that so many GOP senators are finally willing to rebuke Trump's efforts to kill all of this work. That's what's making them so willing to just go, okay, I know he's threatening to primary people who are supporting this bill, but we just cannot get around this anymore. I don't care.
Yeah, I think if you go home to a district where all of the people who are going to vote on whether you get to go back to Congress or say, get this done, do this, work with the other side, mm-hmm. deliver these improvements, then that's really powerful. And that might be more powerful than any kind of partisan political pressure. And, right. and I think that's why you see this remarkable coalition. By the way, not just the most ideologically moderate Republicans and the most ideologically moderate Democrats, right? We're talking about some very conservative Republicans, some very progressive Democrats saying, all right, let's do this.
Are there any other issues on Biden's agenda where there are 10 Republican votes?
Well, we've had some progress on areas around America. I think everybody understands things like supply chain, chips, mm-hmm. you know, a serious issue with a shortage of semiconductors and microchips.
Right.
Cars that are otherwise ready to go can't be completed in America or sold. So I think on issues like that, we have progress. We do have, obviously, a long way to go on a lot mm-hmm. of issues. I mean, if you look at, you take climate, for example, which right. in so many ways is the defining issue of our time. If you go to a lot of other Western countries where there's very conservative and very left politicians, they're not arguing over whether climate change is real. They're arguing over whose plan for dealing with climate change is better. In other words, right. when a conservative government comes to power in a lot of these countries, they come with a full-throated climate agenda, the same as a social democratic party. And in the right. U.S., it feels like we haven't got there yet, but maybe this transportation bill, which is also going to do a lot of good for America's climate, is an example of how we can make clear that this doesn't have to be strictly partisan. And,
right.
and my hope, I'm not saying this naively, I know what we're up against in terms of the divisions in this country and the extremes that you see out there, but my hope is that if we can deliver one major, solid, meaningful, tangible thing mm-hmm. like this on a bipartisan basis, maybe that's groundwork for some more.
Right, right. Because, I mean, it's the climate crisis, the impact that the climate crisis is having on this country's infrastructure is just undeniable. What are the consequences if we fail to act?
Oh, it's stark, and we're seeing it already. I mean, mm-hmm. give me an example. You got the yeah. Pacific Northwest at these extreme heat conditions. It shouldn't even be possible to get triple-digit temperatures in a place like Portland, Oregon.
Right.
Portland had to shut down their transit system
right.
because the cables that power it were at risk of melting in those temperatures. Because yeah. you build transportation structure according to the climate you think you live in. It's the same as in Texas when the grid went down in those snowstorms.
Right.
It's not like you can't run power during a snowstorm where I come from in northern Indiana or the Midwest do it all the time. It's just that they didn't go for that because they never thought that they would have to.
Right.
And so what we're seeing now is two things. One, we have to build our infrastructure to be more resilient because these climate problems are upon us now. We've got a road in the low-lying area that's getting washed out every third year. Maybe mm-hmm. don't put it back the exact same. Maybe build it better. But the other thing, of course, is to make sure the climate doesn't get worse. And this is another very, very important part of transportation policy. Every transportation choice is a climate choice, whether we call it that or not.
Right.
For the simple reason, the transportation sector is actually the one emitting the most greenhouse gases. So when we decide whether we're going to do public transit, whether we're going to invest in rail, what kind of standards we apply to the emissions of vehicles, or what we're going to do with aviation for the future, even just where a road goes, all right. of these are actually climate decisions too.
Right. Who loves trains more, you or President Biden?
I'm not going to try to overtake the president on that one, but I'm trying to run a very close second.
Okay.
Train fans of this administration. But yeah, I think he counted up the miles that he traveled on Amtrak. And was like,
right.
He was definitely first place on that.
Okay, first place. Okay, when Biden was elected, he rolled out an ambitious goal of converting the entire fleet of federal cars to electric zero-emission vehicles. Where does that project stand? And how likely is it that you will actually achieve that goal by the end of the president's first term?
So we're definitely moving in that direction. It's going to take a lot. I mean, you have vehicles that we bought with a 10, 20. I was on a ship, the Department of Transportation managers, a few days ago that was made the year I was born, 1982.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's going to take a while through the entire fleet of federally owned transportation assets. But we're underway and we've got to move faster and faster.
Right.
A big area where we can do this, for example, is postal service. Just think about how many of those trucks there are, right?
Right.
What's helpful about this is the more we do it, the more we're contributing to a market where more money is made, that makes more cheaper, and that helps on the consumer side too. So we're actively looking at how to do this in our department, which has relatively few cars and trucks. We do, like any government agency, have our share.
Right.
And the president's pressing all of us to make plans to do this from, you know, a small fleet like the Department of Transportation to the U.S. military, which also needs some
infrastructure. Right. And you've got to build charging stations all over the country, not just in urban centers. What can electric vehicles do for rural communities as well?
So I think one thing that's been underreported is just how meaningful electric vehicles are. If you live in a rural area, right, it's more spread out. It takes more time to get to school or get to work. So that means you're going to save more money if you have an electric vehicle, because you've been burning more gas, which means more of your budget goes to gas. So that's one reason. A second reason is, you're right, the charging infrastructure needs to be available across the country. But it's also true that if you live in a rural area, you're more likely to live in a standalone house. And there's a very simple kind of charging infrastructure, which is the plug-in level. It's great to have a level two and then funnel up, but most plug-in electric vehicles, if you need to, I mean, this is how, you know, Jess and I have a plug-in hybrid car in South Bend.
Right.
And there's a third reason, which is electric pickup trucks actually have better torque, which is better for towing, which a lot of people in rural applications are more likely to use. So I know there's this perception that electric vehicles are a kind of city thing, but there's actually a huge opportunity on the rural side.
Yeah. How do you bring that message out? Because I do think a lot of people still have, they have, you know, electric toys for their kids, and they're like, the charge runs out all the time on right. Derek's electric scooter. What are you talking? I can't afford that. I can't run out of, yeah. I can't run out of charge while I'm driving to a job.
Right. No, I mean, these things can run 200, 300, 400 miles on charge.
Right.
And so, you know, part of it's making sure Americans are aware of, by the way, not just what's being produced, but what's being produced right here in America. That's why it was exciting to see the president go to the plant where they make electric F-150s.
Right.
To make sure Americans understand that there's such a thing as an electric pickup truck, that it's American made and it's pretty amazing. And this is true both in terms of Detroit, and then you have a lot of these newer companies. Now, in the end, it's these companies' job, right? The federal government doesn't make and sell cars. These companies have a job to market their vehicles. But we do have a policy choice to make, which is, how do we make sure that there's charging infrastructure so you never have to think twice about these things if you're going on a long haul? How do we make sure that there's policies that make them more affordable, right? It's easy. Right. It's easy to sit here and say, buy an electric vehicle, you save a lot of gas money. But if the sticker price of the vehicle is out of your range, that's not going to be paid. So we've got to make sure it's more affordable on the front end. There's a lot of legislation to do that. As we make that transition, it's going to make everyone better off. And the real question is whether this transition will happen. It will. I mean, this is clearly the future.
Right.
The question is, will it happen quickly enough to meet our climate goal?
Right.
Will it get to everybody equitably? And will it be made in America? And those three questions really do depend on what we do with things like legislation to encourage electric vehicles.
Right. We've talked about breaking the false narrative that fighting climate change and creating jobs are at odds with each other. Why has the right been so successful at perpetuating that myth?
You know, I think there's a resistance to change and a fear of change, which I totally understand. I come from a part of the Midwest where, you know, a lot of auto supply chain and auto manufacturing is a huge part of the economy. My hometown of South Bend was a company founded for Studebaker back when that was a major automaker, giant until it collapsed in the 1960s. But even into the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and even today, there's a ton of auto industry there. And a lot of promises were made in the 90s at the time of the issue of trade. Mm-hmm. And folks, you know, including a lot of people in positions of visibility in the government, came along and said, you're going to be fine. This is going to change, but there's going to be more than enough from the wins that the losers will be made better off by the extra gains that come to the wins. It just didn't happen. The pie got bigger.
Right.
But the slice of the pie that went to a lot of people from did not. And so there's a reason why there's skepticism and suspicion. But in this case, it's also clearly the case that we can create more jobs than ever. This is not just us saying that. We've got independent analysts like Moody's running the numbers on the president's jobs vision, including or especially the climate elements of it. And you add it all up together, we have millions more jobs if we do this than if we don't. Plus, you got the cost of doing nothing. How many jobs are destroyed when you have infrastructure that is wrecked by more extreme climate events? How many livelihoods are destroyed when you have everything from heat waves to floods picking up? So, you know, if you step back and look at it, this is clearly a win. But, you know, you can't expect everybody to just automatically accept that. We have to go out and make the case. And that's what the president has been doing. That's what we're all doing.
Right. You need more days in the week and more hours in the day. Can you legislate that?
I keep asking my staff if there's a way to just slow the rotation of the earth because of the hours in the day.
And, you should be able to do that.
Apparently it's harder than it's at.
Okay. Well, you need to put a team on that. Okay. You mentioned Indiana. And so I do have to ask, what is the deal with your former governor, Mike Pence? Like, okay, he's been strangely quiet. Will Mother allow him to run in 2024? Do you see that on the horizon?
I dare not speculate on the political decision-making that folks like him are going through. It's obviously been a, you know, especially after January 6th, the consequences of the choices that were made. And I have a hard time putting myself in that headspace to understand how some folks have made the decisions that they have. But, you know, what I do know is that, you know, we've got a job to do on our side. Keep pushing, and even in a deeply conservative place like Indiana, where I come from, I think people are going to see their lives get better because of the work.
How do we get more of our best and brightest young people to get involved in public service instead of going into the social media influencer service?
You're saying social media influencing isn't public service?
Oh, I mean, it's very important. No one can deny that.
I mean, I think we have to... Well, the good news is a younger generation is fairly engaged and very passionate. I think much more than... I feel like when I was in college, it wasn't really cool to care about politics. You were supposed to be kind of ironic about those things. So you didn't want to reveal yourself to be very committed to anything in particular. And I think culturally that is somehow totally shifted. But I think we do need to make clear that if you actually want these changes to happen, you have to engage in specific political processes to change specific policies. And, you know, I think people have empowering experiences when they do that. And it's not just, you know, getting a job in a presidential campaign going on to work at the White House, although I'm excited when that happens. But sometimes it's showing up at what sounds like a boring, you know, zoning meeting in your community where actually a decision might be made differently because you spoke up about, you know, the environmental or economic or social consequences. Some choice that's got to be made where you live. So encouraging people to engage at every level, including or especially the local level, where you're more likely to get heard right away, and making clear that all of the things we talk about, they're going to come down to whether we have better policies or worse policies.
Right.
And again, you don't have to be a government official involved in policy, although I'd love to see more people. We're trying to recruit more young people to get involved in the Department of Transportation, and not just in the politics or policy side of it, but just the careers that's there. And frankly, there's a big gap, especially for women and for people of color working in the transportation sector and working in our department. And I think we can do something about that. We were in Baltimore a few days ago with a drone academy that is teaching middle school age kids from neighborhood Baltimore that has been underserved and overburdened. They're making drones. And my hope is some of them will wind up in a place like the FAA making decisions. And it's exciting to see that. But we've got to make sure people who haven't always seen people who look like them in positions of leadership, especially in tech-heavy areas, to realize that there's a place for them.
Right. That's a pretty good lead-in to my next question, which is really about education and remote schooling, which we've all gotten come to love so deeply. So we've had a year of remote school and remote work, two things that would not be possible without the internet. Not possible at all. How do you still respond to the argument that the internet and broadband aren't infrastructure, which, like, I can't believe people would even think in those terms, because it is impossible to participate in this world without it.
That's right. I mean, if you want to do a job, if you want to do homework, anything, you need an internet connection. And a lot of Americans don't, or they don't have an affordable internet connection.
Right.
Basically the same thing. And that's one of the reasons why this bipartisan infrastructure deal put together has the resources to keep every American connected. But the way I think about it is you need to be connected to the interstate highway system somehow, and you need a connection to the internet. You need both. And yeah, this isn't maybe what they would call traditional industry. But no, neither were railroads until we built on them. I mean, at one point, railroads were just another new technology. And then we went big on them, and it transformed America and brought America together. Same is true with the internet right now. And there are deep inequities and divisions in terms of who has access. It's one of the biggest things we can do to help expand opportunity. And I'm really glad that's part of this package.
Right, right. Okay, Mr. Transportation, what's your favorite way to get places? We've established that you're the second most train-using person. What is your favorite way to go from place to place?
You never want to pick one of your modes of transportation, right? I mean, it depends on what you do. I will say I'm on the bike a lot. I like biking around Washington. It's actually a pretty bike-friendly city. And taking a lot of steps to make it safe and easy with bike lanes. Walking is a pretty overlooked mode of transportation.
Very overlooked.
It's the original one.
It's the original.
First one we ever had.
Built for it.
So I'm big on that. But, you know, there's also a lot of exciting stuff happening. Aviation, to go to the other extreme. I don't think I'll be a commercial space travel passenger anytime soon, but there's a lot going on in that space.
Really? I mean, Jeff Bezos obviously recently paid for himself to go to space, among others, aside from all of the jokes that do come with, you know, torpedoing yourself in a penis-shaped spacecraft into outer space. Is that something that could become a normal part of our transportation? I kind of hope not. I'm not into space. I don't really want to go there. Do you have a desire to do that?
Oh, I'd love to go.
Oh, you would?
Yeah. It's not quite in our family budget, but it's a chance trip. Sure. I think, you know, obviously most of the applications are commercial and scientific, but you know, every field reaches a point where private activity can pick up where we used to only be public sector activity. And then our responsibility is just to make sure it goes well. Our biggest thing is partners, which is sick. So right now, commercial space travel is so new that the overall regulatory framework basically is along the lines of fly at your own risk. I'm simplifying, that's basically. But we really, really care about, first of all, making sure nobody gets hurt on the ground.
Right.
And secondly, in order to get between the ground and space, you have to go through the national airspace where our aircraft are. And obviously, it's extremely important that there not be any safety problems there. So that's what we manage right now as a department. And then we'll see where things develop. I don't think anybody expects to have the same safety standard as a passenger on these things that you are in an airline, right? Where we have obviously a zero acceptable risk. And by the way, this is an example of how good policy quietly works in the background on infrastructure we've been done. 20, 50, certainly 70 years ago, the rates that we were accepting of crashes and problems happening with airplanes were way higher than now, where it is, you know, thankfully so rare to have a fatality. And I think we actually need to come full circle and apply that same attitude now to cars. We just accept that people we know will die in car crashes.
Right.
But that's normal.
Right.
Because we're reduced. And it actually doesn't have to be. There are steps we can take to dramatically reduce vehicle fatalities, and we should.
Oh, tell me about those steps. I want to hear all about those. What do you mean?
Well, part of it's design, the way that roads are designed.
Right.
Are they just built for speed, or are they built for safety?
Right.
Part of it is the design of vehicles. This is why we have things like the 5-star rating and a lot of transparency about how safe the vehicle is. Part of it, of course, is drivers. And one thing that's especially important is, you know, all of these technologies that exist to assist drivers, you know, the kind of cruise control that can tell if there's a car in front of you, the lane assist, the kind of bumps you back in your lane, they can be great for safety, but only if they're used properly. if you think that you don't have to pay attention to anything, you are wrong. And it's important for people to understand there's no vehicle for sale right now where these features mean that you can pay less attention.
Are you telling me in this conversation that there are people who think that their drive assist is going to drive the car for them and they just completely tune out at the wheel?
Yeah. And you know, God. Do not do that.
It's
really, now some of them even have a feature to check whether you're paying attention while you're using the other features.
Right.
My mom's car does it. Mm-hmm. A coffee cup shows up, which I guess symbolizes like, hey, perfect. If it thinks that your eyes are red. Now, of course, what we're contemplating for the medium is cars that can drive without you paying it.
Right.
Fully automated cars, which could actually have a great safety benefit because human drivers have such a mixed track record for safety. But you know, we gotta have the right kind of regulations.
Right.
So there's a lot that can happen. And by the way, a lot of cities, a lot of countries are actually very impressed with it. I know it's almost too easy to point to the Scandinavian policy humans, but they're always delivering something impressive. But there are cities in Oslo, for example. They went through a year with, in a city of 600,000 people, so it's about the size of, let's say, Oklahoma City or Portland. They went through a year with zero traffic fatalities.
Wow.
Or zero in vehicle, I think zero pedestrian cyclist fatalities. I think one fatality in a single car crash.
Really?
In an entire year. And my attitude is if they can, why can't they?
Yeah, that's impressive. Oh my God. Okay. All right.
I want us to get to where, like, the idea of accepting that somebody you know would die in a car crash
right.
seems as quaint as the idea that somebody you know might die in a duel. Like, I just want it to seem that silly and antiquated.
Right.
But we got a long way to go.
It's very reasonable. I support you in this endeavor. In this and all endeavors. Okay, this has been a great conversation. Thank you for your frankness and thank you for your openness to talk. My goodness. Okay, I just have a couple more questions for you. I did want to ask, you know, this country's attitudes on same-sex marriage have shifted so dramatically in the last decade, and thank God for that. But what do you think needs to happen for there to be more of an evolution on thought about the trans community and trans kids?
First of all, we have to stick up for trans kids.
Right.
And frankly, that's true even within the LGBTQ community. We can't say that because a guy like me is able to get married now, that the struggle is somehow over,
right.
knowing what trans kids are going through. I think a lot of it is standing up to politicians who try to exploit this. I mean, we're talking about a lot of political figures who are pretty sure a trans teenager never did anything to them, never caused a problem for them, mm-hmm. but they've decided to try to score political points with this terrible legislation that picks on some of the most vulnerable people in our society. Think about how hard high school is. Think about how terrifying middle school is when you're not transgender.
Right.
And then think about how much harder and more challenging it is when you are. So we're talking about fellow vulnerable youth. We need to support and empower to achieve everything that they're going to be able to achieve in life, just like anybody else. And that's an all-of-society thing. It can't just be a political issue.
Right.
But I think it starts with speaking up and with recognizing that it's not okay to go after a community of people to try to make political pay.
Right. Well, in your job, you have to have a lot of face time with Republican lawmakers or lawmakers who are openly hostile to the LGBTQ plus community. How do you do that? How do you manage to work with people who like hate your community? How do you manage?
Well, there's some compartmentalizing that goes on.
Right.
As you might imagine.
Yep.
Same as when I was a mayor in like Pence's Indiana, trying to deliver for my city and work for the state government. But I'll also say that people can change. And I hold out hope and faith even that if you get to know people and they get to know you, people who do not think of themselves as full of discriminatory contempt might in time come to see their responsibility to make this a safer and more inclusive place. And sometimes you do that quietly, sometimes you do that very loudly. And you know, one thing that I certainly saw in my own Indiana hometown is that a lot of people, especially if you start where they are and then get them to what you'd like them to see, a lot of people who just never thought about it in a certain way can become amazing allies, give them a chance. And that's my hope for even most frighteningly anti-equality corners of our political landscape.
You got a lot of hope. Some might even say you have high hopes.
Well, I see what you did there.
Some might even say... Okay. All right. This is my last question, and it's a doozy. So prepare yourself. Okay. This is a good one. This is a good one. And I want to thank you for this entire interview because it's been great talking to you, but this one, gird your loins. Okay. I have heard that you and your husband, Chasten, are exploring the possibility of starting a family. How do you feel about the fact that Chasten will almost certainly be considered the cool dad?
No,
I'm joking. No,
you but know, sometimes seriously. You just sometimes a reality presents itself, and you just have to. You just have
just
to
go with it.
So I'll be ready with the dad jokes.
Oh my gosh, I have to thank you again. Please say hello to Chasten for us. We are
sure
super big fans, and I just think you're out there doing the Lord's work, and I appreciate it.
We're working hard. Not that much. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. I need to squeeze in another quick break here. That was so great. Oh my God, he is so fun to talk to. That was exciting.
Subway poop stories for the transportation secretary. That's very weird.
That's regrettable.
He has them. He's just too nice to talk about them.
I feel like we're so relevant now that we have actual functioning cabinet members on the show. Yeah. Now it's real.
Legislation is being made on this show. Why not?
Oh, why not? Make it all. Okay. All right. Yeah. So
speaking of being a functional cabinet member, you know, we like to speculate sometimes on this show about alternative careers for you. So we wanted to think about if you were a cabinet member, how would you approach your job? Mm. So basically, inspired by Secretary Buttigieg, we wanted to see what your first priority would be if you were to theoretically fill any of the following roles. Obviously, this will never happen, but a podcast gal can dream.
Obviously, it will never happen.
Okay, I know.
It will never. No. Oh, God. I'm so bad at all of this. I don't even. Oh, no. I don't have any ideas.
Well,
okay.
The good news is that anything you say will have no consequences whatsoever. So
that's great.
You won't be setting actual policy. But let's say you were Secretary of State, for instance. What do you think? Whoever inherits that role, I guess it's Tony Blinken in real life, what would you would be encountering?
Oh my God, I would probably try to achieve world peace, right?
All right, on day one, good.
Day one, world peace. That's no problem.
All right. Well, that's kind of related to this next one. What if you were a defense secretary?
World peace.
Okay. Sensing a theme.
I would dismantle our defense systems. I would actually, I would be the world's worst defense secretary because I was just watching a video about this aircraft carrier. Mm. It is nuts, what this aircraft carrier is capable of. And I was just listening to all the information about it. And I was this is ridiculous. We shouldn't have this. This should not exist. So probably I would ruin everything for everybody.
Ruin or make completely better. It's really tough to say.
Make completely better and ruin things for others.
Sure.
Anyways, no one wants me doing that job. I can tell you that.
Well, you have, maybe this one is a little bit closer to home because you do have school-age kids who've gone through the school system here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. If you were education secretary, what do you think needs to be fixed? What doesn't need to be fixed, I guess, is really the question.
Doesn't need to be fixed? That is a job that I absolutely could not do, but I would definitely be better at it than Betsy DeVos. So that's all I can tell
you.
First things first, I would get bear spray in the hands of every man, woman, and child in the education system, just in case.
What about if you were Treasury Secretary?
Oh, I would go like this. Okay. Day one, how do I bequeath my powers to Elizabeth Warren? I also shouldn't be doing this job. I don't understand any of these systems.
I don't know. Maybe the U.S. could use a toonie.
Oh, loonies and toonies. Our listeners don't know what that means.
I don't know what that means. What does that mean?
In Canada, where I grew up with my people, we don't have dollar bills. We have $1 coins and we have $2 coins, and we call, because they have a loon on them, they're called
Loonies. The loony is the one, and the toonie is is a two, which means okay. You just always walk around with so much change in your pockets.
Yeah, like everyone so needs much little change. Coin purses.
Sure.
Oh, big coin purses, because if you buy something for a dollar two, we also, anyways, whatever, you get so much change. You have like a loony, a toonie, nickels, quarter. You just need, it's just change purses all over the place.
Okay. So this last one's the big, to me, this is the biggest one because I feel like it's the hardest job going right now.
Okay.
Attorney General.
Oh my God.
I know. There's so much. There's the invasion. So there's all much. The Trump crimes. There's, yeah.
Well, I definitely, reform. Oh boy. I don't even know where I would start. Oh my God. That's like a 24-hour. Well, first thing I would mandate is that we have 8 days a week to tackle all the problems that we have. And I have to work 24 steps. So I have to find a way to make myself bionic. Find a way to reach out. I don't know. You know what? You said, Samantha Bee, you are now the Attorney General. And I immediately went, I need to investigate what type of self-care it would take to do this job. There's actually
that's
too
probably
much.
The proper first question. More people need to ask that question when they start a tough job.
How can I add days and hours to this job?
Yeah.
Very tough. Boy, yeah. I don't want to do any of these jobs.
Yeah. Merrick Garland's hair is already fully white, so I assume by the end it's going to have fallen out.
I don't think that my highlights could handle any of those jobs. I would just go like full.
Eva would never let you do that job.
No, I think that the white hair would just break through the highlights and just be like, no. I would just wake up just full Bride of Frankenstein.
Hurling cats at people.
Hurling cats. I hope you liked my podcast. If you did, let me know in the comments. If you didn't, well, just consider hate listening in the future. Seriously, though, please rate, review, and follow Full Release and Apple Podcasts and tell your friends. Spread the word about this podcast. And if you know someone who doesn't know what podcasts are and or where to find them, don't shame them. Offer to help them. And in the meantime, keep sending us your comments and questions to fullrelease@sambee.com. They might even be featured in one of our special bonus episodes, exclusively available on Stitcher Premium. Don't forget to tune into Full Frontal with Samantha Bee Wednesdays at 10:30 p.m. on TBS. And we'll see you next Tuesday for another Full Release. This podcast is brought to you by Earwolf and TBS and was produced by Adam Howard and Svea Baron-Reinstein, with research provided by Maureen Malik, and IT and technical production provided by Hightech. It was edited by Julia Plott and hosted by me, Samantha Bee.
Pete's ready.
Oh my God, I'm so excited. Okay, great. Ready anytime. Diddly-doo, diddly-doo.